This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can watch our TV show on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV's on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The Syrian government is claiming it now controls part of the key rebel-held city of Aleppo this week. The announcement comes after days of warnings issued by human rights groups about the relentless bombing of civilian neighborhoods in Aleppo that have hurt children in particular. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, said if the bombing of Aleppo continues, the entire city, quote, may be totally destroyed. There are currently more than three quarters of a million people in Aleppo. But as Aleppo is facing destruction, a long simmering war has broken out within the U.S. left over the issue of Syria. A two-part investigation by journalist Max Blumenthal into the Syria campaign and the White Helmets group has provoked the ire of those who are opposed to the Assad regime. My guest is Rahul Mahajan. He is a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin, a news analyst as well, and the author of two books on the Iraq Wars, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, as well as The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. And he's also the U.S. Foreign Policy and Empire Correspondent for Rising Up. Welcome back to the show, Rahul.
Great to be with you again, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about simply what's happening in Aleppo. The warnings about Aleppo have been unfolding since August. The images coming out of there are horrific. There are various groups. Some are saying the rebels are not letting people out. Others are saying it's the government bombing that's causing the most damage. As far as you can understand, why is this battle so centered on Aleppo? Is it because this is a city that the rebels, in quotes, consider their stronghold?
Well, you know, at different times in the war, which has been going on for 5 years, different areas have been flashpoints. So a major episode, and I thought at the time a major turning point in the war, was actually the fall of Homs, where there was at the end, after a sort of ceaseless government siege and bombing campaign, a negotiated agreement in which rebels were allowed to leave in return basically for surrendering the city. So, you know, Homs, which has, you know, been since the 70s actually, sort of flashpoint of resistance to the Assad regime, was taken out of the equation early on. Parts of Damascus at other times were major flashpoints in the war. Right now, it's moved to Aleppo, and if things go as they are, within a few months, presumably the epicenter will move somewhere else. But of course, Aleppo is of particular importance since it's the second largest city in Syria, as almost anyone but Gary Johnson could tell you.
Gary Johnson being the Libertarian presidential candidate who did not know what Aleppo was when asked. So, I mean, it's far from a joke, of course, if you look at what's emerging from Aleppo. And I think part of the confusion over what to do about Syria lies with how many actors there are. Internationally, there's, Russia, Putin's Russia, that is supporting it, the Assad regime. You have Iran in Syria as well, the U.S. joining Syria, claiming that its target is the Islamic State. On the ground, multiple forces, not just government forces, but so many different rebel groups and the Islamic State. But in Aleppo, is it clear who are the good guys, who are the bad guys? And I sort of hate to put it in those reductionist terms, but that is part of the reason for this confusion on the American left over Aleppo, over Syria. So who is perpetrating the majority of crimes in Aleppo?
Right. So, I mean, there's one story that's true almost universally throughout the war, and the only exceptions are very localized and only involve basically either ISIS or, in a few cases, Jabhat al-Nusra. In every other case, the vast majority of the crimes, especially against civilians, are being committed by the Assad government. Aleppo is no exception to that. Now, it would be foolish to say that the other side is not engaged in crimes or coercive tactics of any kind. It's very hard to know day to day exactly what's happening on the ground. And it is true, it's a common dynamic in insurgency and counterinsurgency, that both sides try to maintain some control over the population in areas that they have taken. But it's also true that, as I mentioned with regard to Homs, that there have been times when the rebels, when sufficiently outmatched, have not tried to hold the remaining population hostage to the fortunes of resistance to the Assad regime. If anything, they're sort of less brutal and relentless in following the logic of insurgency and counterinsurgency. With regard to, I mean, to concrete specifics, look, it's the Assad regime and the Russians that have been targeting hospitals. So much so that Doctors Without Borders made a decision that they were no longer going to provide GPS coordinates of their facilities to Russia or the Syrian government, because they felt that, in fact, not only would they not be of aid in keeping them from being bombed, they would make those facilities more likely to be bombed. The siege that has kept parts of Aleppo with, you know, decreasing amounts of medical supplies and other key things, including even foodstuffs, is again primarily being put on by the government. The rebels are holding out in incredibly desperate conditions in some parts of the city. I mean, one of the major roads that they had held, the so-called Castello Road, was cut months ago, and I thought at the time that that was the beginning of the end for the rebel presence in Aleppo. But it's been continuing. So, I mean, the overwhelming majority of the atrocities are being committed by the Assad regime, and something you wouldn't necessarily realize from news coverage, the scale of those atrocities is far greater, at least in number, than anything that's been done even by ISIS, let alone other groups in the Syrian conflict.
So, Rahul, acknowledging that reality is what seems to be equated by some on the U.S. left as making a case for U.S.-backed regime change against Syria, which is sort of the heart of this conflict over Max Blumenthal's two-part investigation. I should mention that I did invite Max, you know, someone that I've known personally, fellow journalist, I did invite him to join us on the show today, but he did not respond to that invitation. But is that the main issue, that simply acknowledging Assad's horrific crimes is seen as being equivalent to inviting U.S. regime change?
Well, I mean, I really am puzzled at what Blumenthal was trying to get at with this two-part series. That, yes, there are a number of facts he's uncovered, some of which were, I think, well-known, and some of which were probably less so. And I guess as a journalist, he could always make the case that, you know, throwing together a series of facts that people don't know is of interest. But he seems to be going well beyond that in terms of the kind of framing analysis he wants to put on it. I mean, he's uncovered, for example, the nefarious agenda of USAID to give money to people who risk their lives to pull broken and bleeding children out of the rubble. I don't really, if anything, that makes me feel a little better about USAID than I did before. I don't know why that's supposed to discredit the work of the White Helmets.
So let's talk about this specifically. So Max's piece was to draw attention to the fact that this group called the White Helmets in Syria, which is basically a humanitarian rescue operation that's operating there, that they have been funded by a PR group, have received funding from USAID, and are calling for U.S. military intervention in Syria. He basically says that they are a creation of the West. This is a group on which a Netflix documentary has been made, so it has gotten a lot of attention, a lot of Western sympathetic media coverage, and it's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And so, so in drawing attention to that, I suppose the implication is that this is sort of a front for Western desires to eventually lead up to making the case for humanitarian intervention of the likes that we saw in Yugoslavia under Milosevic.
I mean, there's so many things to say. It seems like such an utterly pointless argument. I mean, first of all, if this is the leading edge of nefarious Western interventionist intentions, then, you know, U.S. imperialism is in even more disarray than it would seem to be on the surface. And I would start worrying about more important things like the invasion of raccoons in American urban spaces or something. I mean, honestly, if nefarious intentions are being sort of pushed through the mechanism of helping to fund an organization that has thousands of volunteers pulling people out of rubble, while the rubble continues to be created at a fantastic pace by Syria, Iran, and Russia, almost without any other opposition except for the internal Syrian rebellion, then they're not really doing very much. I mean, and I wouldn't necessarily worry about it. If the claim is somehow that the fact that the White Helmets want a no-fly zone is indicative of some people who are having bombs dropped on them are very partisan against the idea of bombs being dropped on them, I don't really quite, again, understand what's the point. Of course they don't want bombs dropped on them, and that means they want a no-fly zone. Whether or not they have thought through what might be the implications of that, in the real world we know that if there's going to be a no-fly zone, it would be enforced by the United States, and we know that the U.S. doesn't enforce no-fly zones without first significant bombing campaigns to take out air defense. But I don't know why you would blame someone who's got bombs dropping on his head for calling for a no-fly zone.
Rahul, I remember several years ago when the Syria war first began, interviewing a couple of Syrian origin living in Los Angeles who were watching with horror as the Assad regime cracked down on the uprising in Syria. And I remember them calling for a no-fly zone then. And, it certainly didn't seem like it seems, of course, like a naive thing to ask for. But at the same time, you're right. This notion that people have bombs dropping on their head are going to call for a no-fly zone is one thing. The question is the U.S. going to give in? And so far, it seems, at least under Obama, that he has been very reluctantly dragged into the Syria war, if you just measure it by the overt role of the U.S. in Syria under the guise of attacking the Islamic State. Would you characterize, in fact, as U.S. actions in Syria so far as being reluctant? Because that's how they're sort of seen in the mainstream. The Republicans blame Obama for not being tough enough and acting swiftly enough in Syria. But we are bombing Syria.
Well, Obama has not only been phenomenally reluctant, he still hasn't been dragged into, in any serious way, the main battlefield of the Syrian civil war. As he was being dragged in the last couple of years, it's almost all been in the fight against ISIS, to the point where the United States reconfigured all of its, very, very minimal support for resistance groups in Syria to require that anyone who took their aid and training pledge only to fight ISIS and not the Assad regime. Again, this is the stuff you can find easily enough in the newspapers, and there's no reason to believe it's not the case. So yes, if there's anyone who won't actually succumb to calls for any sort of even face-saving humanitarian measures in Syria, it is Obama. I mean, you can see everyone from John Kerry to Mike Pence at least seems to be calling for something. And we saw Kane and Pence actually agree on creating something they call a safe zone in Aleppo, a concept that has, rarely been sort of meaningfully implemented and certainly is not going to happen with the United States now. But it's pretty clear that Obama stands well apart from the mainstream here, even rhetorically.
And we should just make it really clear, even if there may be Syrians on the ground calling for the U.S. to intervene, you and I know that's a terrible idea. Let's just put it out there, lest this conversation become the focus of certain factions on the left as being equivalent to calling for U.S.-backed regime change in Syria. I mean, the two things can be true at once, that it can, one can call out Bashar al-Assad's horrific crimes, name him as the main perpetrator of violence in Syria, and be against U.S. intervention in Syria, right? I mean, this reminds me of the battle that on the left that took place before the Iraq intervention.
Well, okay, so yes, you can. Now, if you want to cling to the idea that you should take policy stands that you could at least in theory fight for, and that they would then sort of actually have the effects you want. Well, okay, so you're against any U.S. intervention, including a no-fly zone in Syria, then exactly how do you think that the outcome in Syria you want is going to be brought about by, especially by any actions that an American activist can take? You'll be hard-pressed to figure out an alternative even to push for. So you can take the relatively impotent position of saying, I wish that these various good things would happen, but I'm not going to advocate anything I think would be likely to make them happen. Or you can say, I'll advocate these things, which are very likely, A, to backfire in ways you can't yet predict, and B, as always, to remember that even if you support a no-fly zone, that doesn't mean you're administering the no-fly zone. It would still be the U.S. government, even if at the end of some massive political campaign they agreed to. So you either take the position of saying I'll remain pure and not advocate anything that might make a difference, or you advocate something that might make a difference but might also end up causing problems, possibly even more problems than it could. But one thing that I absolutely think is should be avoided is to let your desire for advocating something that might have a chance of working on either side sort of distort your recognition of reality. So if you're so in favor of a no-fly zone that you ignore the way the United States has administered no-fly zones and what its agenda might be, or if you're so against a no-fly zone that you think that anyone who's in favor of it is objectively a pro-imperialist, that kind of thing at the very least should be avoided.
Well, things have gotten pretty vitriolic online, especially we're in the age of social media where it's so easy to hurl insults at one another directly on Twitter. And Max Blumenthal has really become targeted by a lot of folks who are, you know, especially a lot of Syrians and Arab Americans, not all, many. There are Arab Americans on the other side as well. And so it's become this sort of kind of painful battle to watch unfold. And I have friends and allies on both sides. It seems somewhat counterproductive. Not that, of course, any battle on the left, sadly, has any bearing whatsoever on what actually happens on the ground. So on the ground, what is the international action, if any, on a diplomatic level that is happening right now? The United Nations has proven to be a completely ineffective vehicle for any kind of change. Are we basically to just sit back and watch these massacres unfold?
Well, you know, by the way, parenthetically, I have been wondering how much of the split you're seeing in the, as you mentioned, completely ineffectual and marginal American left on social media is actually in part reflecting some dynamics on the ground that people may not be aware of. For example, one of the active pro-Assad regime militias fighting right now in Aleppo, the Liwa al-Quds, is a Palestinian force. So despite the fact that pretty much all Palestinian Muslims are Sunnis, they're fighting on the side of the Assad regime, and in part because there have been long-standing connections between some Palestinian resistance groups and the Assad regime, both Hafez and Bashar. So some of the split you're seeing is between Palestine activists and Syria activists, and it may be reflective of, among other things, some deeper splits on the ground. But with regard to what can be done, I mean, this is the question we always come back to that nobody has a clear answer for, except to say what I think is obvious, that the only force that can wield sufficient coercion to actually get people to agree to some sort of accommodation that involves less violence is the United States. And the only way it can wield that coercion is to actually, at least parenthetically, threaten violence. I mean, I just don't see any other way to talk seriously about what should be done. With regard to Iran, I mean, I think that probably a lot of people, even on the left, are happy about the agreement that the United States made with Iran, which seems to at least have put an end to any potential Iranian efforts to have a nuclear bomb, and has led to the unfreezing of Iranian assets and the relative thawing of U.S.-Iranian relations, at least until Donald Trump gets into office. But again, that wouldn't have happened either without the U.S. use of coercive measures. So, you know, there you have it. That's where we are. If you believe the U.S. coercion is so fundamentally vitiated a force like, say, the Nazis, that nothing it pushes for, it tries to accomplish can be any good, then there's nothing for you to push for at this time.
Wow. Well, Rahul, I appreciate your nuanced critique on this issue. And, you know, I mean, putting it into perspective, at least realistically speaking, is something that we do need to do. I want to thank you, as always, for joining us. I'm sure we'll have you back on in the future talking about, hopefully not this war, but probably. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Rahul Mahajan is a PhD student in sociology at the University of Wisconsin and a news analyst. He's the author of two books on the Iraq War, Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond, and The New Crusade, America's War on Terrorism. He's also our U.S. foreign policy and empire correspondent. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.